Governor Gavin Newsom talked about the graying of California in his State of the State address. Seniors are the fastest growing age group in the state. On Insight, we'll explore this segment of California's population in a new California Dream series. Reporters Matt Levin, Julia Mitrich, and Sammy Kaola will share their work. Then the complicated issues that come with testing your DNA. Maybe you have relatives you've never met. Maybe your DNA says you're predisposed to cancer. There are promises, pitfalls, and social risks, as two UC Davis professors will explain. Later in the hour, writer Rachel Howard joins me. Her debut novel, titled The Risk of Us, walks us through the intense landscape of a young couple and the child they might adopt. Rachel takes on the subject of childhood trauma and what it takes to be a family. I'm Beth Ruyak. Insight is just ahead. Live from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. When California Governor Gavin Newsom made a reference to the graying of California in his State of the State address, he said, quote, "We need to get ready for the major demographic challenge headed our way." And then he added, "Growing old knows no boundaries. Aging doesn't care what race you are, your economic status, or if you're single with no other family support." So it is a point of fact that seniors are the fastest growing age group in the state. And to explore this further, Cap Radio has launched a new California Dream series called Graying California. This is a statewide project with several public radio stations and CalMatters. So here's CalMatters data and housing reporter Matt Levin to set the stage.
California is not ready for this. Advocacy groups like AARP California say the issue is getting much more attention than it's gotten in years past. Governor Gavin Newsom has called for a master plan on aging, similar to the master plan on higher education that was devised decades ago. And the legislature is working on that right now. But you talk to experts and the consensus is pretty clear. Our healthcare systems, our transportation systems, our infrastructure in general was designed for a much younger California. And we are simply not that young anymore.
That's Matt Levin, and he goes on to talk about the numbers in detail.
We have about 6 million Californians currently over the age of 65. That's a really big number. That's more than the entire population of Oregon. And it's only projected to grow pretty dramatically. By 2030, we're projected to have 9 million seniors. One out of every five Californians will be a senior by then. That's a higher proportion of seniors than what currently exists in Florida, which is a state pretty much synonymous with retirees.
Matt says there's one group in particular that's dominating this graying part of the population.
California was one of the greatest generation's favorite places to have kids. Now those baby boomers, that generation born after World War II and into the 1960s, are entering their golden years. And it's not just old white people, which I think is the stereotype that a lot of people have in mind in terms of California seniors. About 60% of California seniors are white, but that's changing. Within a decade, California seniors will be majority minority, which mirrors the rest of the state.
That's CalMatters data and housing reporter Matt Levin. So who exactly are these graying Californians? That's the question our reporters have taken on, and I'm joined by Cap Radio's food and sustainability reporter, Julia Mitrich.
Good to be here.
And our healthcare reporter, Sammy Kaola, is here too. Hi, Sammy.
Good morning, Beth.
Glad to have you here. So you both have produced stories for this series. Sammy, let's start with you, and let's talk about the main character that you've profiled.
Sure. So I talked to a man named Cliff Shockney. He's 72, a pianist, kind of a quiet type, and he lives alone because he lost his partner. So him and Tony had both moved to California to try to live more freely and comfortably as gay men. They were together for 29 years, but in 2011, Tony died of liver cancer after living with HIV and AIDS for decades. So it was a huge turn in Cliff's life. And, you know, he still lives in their house, which is really beautiful. It's in a suburban Sacramento neighborhood. It's full of art that they collected together. It's got a huge piano in the living room. And they used to host a lot of parties there, and they used to go on a lot of trips together. And so Cliff is now in this place where he's just, you know, not really sure what the rest of his days look like at 72. And he's not sure who's going to take care of him when he gets older, if his health changes, if he becomes, you know, unable to take care of himself. And, you know, isolation is a big problem for him. He says he does have a lot of friends, but it's not the same as having someone who's your rock, your companion. And when he's gone out to bars or clubs to try to meet people, he says he just feels kind of out of place. And here's how he describes it.
In general, in the gay community, there traditionally has been an emphasis on being young and attractive and sexually active. Older people were just kind of invisible. They weren't viewed as sex objects. And so you find yourself older and kind of marginalized, and if you don't get out there and do something, it's really easy to just stay in your own little world.
So that's why he's tried to go out of his way to find social groups that are explicitly for LGBT seniors, because he's trying to find, A, friends, but also a romantic companion. And he says it's been hard to make those deep connections this late in life.
I think loneliness in this age group is a standard challenge.
Definitely.
And battle, perhaps. Let's talk about some of the other challenges for the way he identifies his social circle to be. And could an LGBTQ-friendly senior living facility help? Does that even exist yet?
So a few of them do across the state. I've talked to a lot of experts and advocates who say that we need more, because you're ending up with a lot of LGBTQ people who didn't marry or didn't have children because there were barriers to doing that, you know, just discrimination and legal barriers. And they maybe recently came out of the closet after decades, and they've been through a lot of stress and trauma just from living kind of a tough life. Mm. And, you know, they want to be around people who have similar experiences. And they're not necessarily comfortable in nursing homes or assisted living facilities. One survey from AARP found that more than half of LGBTQ people over 45 said they'd have to hide their identities to safely access senior living facilities. So they'd basically have to go back into the closet.
More than half said that.
More than half said that. Mm. So, you know, they're really not wanting to be in those kind of catch-all senior living facilities. I talked to Marcy Edelman. She's a psychologist and a housing advocate. And part of what she does is she goes around to nursing homes and she offers trainings on how to better care for LGBTQ patients. And she says that the staff are just not always sensitive to these patients' needs.
They may not use the pronouns that person prefers, or what kind of roommate, or so to respect and help LGBT seniors feel safe and comfortable so they can just focus on their health and getting well. You need to have people that are caring for them understand who they are and how best to take care of them.
So Beth, you asked if these exist, and there is one in San Francisco that I actually had a chance to visit. Mm. It's sort of an LGBT senior apartment building. The day that I went, they were having a transgender elder lunch. Mm. So these are older people who transition genders, some of them early in life, some of them quite late in life. And, you know, a lot of them were sort of political activists in the 70s. So when I was there at lunch, they were kind of trading war stories. Some of them were complaining about discrimination that they face when they walk around in the world. And it was just neat to see that sense of camaraderie. And so people like Marcy are really pushing for more of that. And it's not just a social thing. They've got unique medical needs, too. Mm. There are people who were diagnosed with HIV decades ago and were on some really strong antiretroviral medications, you know, in the early days before those drugs were made a little safer. Mm. And so they're having some side effects now that, you know, people weren't expecting. This is sort of the first generation to live with HIV for that long. And also people who are transitioning genders require special medical care too. And if senior living facilities aren't trained to administer those types of medications, you can run into problems. So, you know, I think the point being, when California is mapping out its plan for aging, LGBTQ advocates are saying you need to take this group into special consideration.
It does get us to that conversation about the spectrum between surviving and thriving. You know, where is your quality of life really full? And I keep coming back to the word vibrant, which isn't a given at this stage of life.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's not just about making it that far. It's about, yeah, having some dignity and some joy.
I think the goal in this series is to show many different examples of people who are moving into this graying of California. So thank you, Sammy. I'm going to point people to the website for a fuller version of the story and more stories ahead.
Thanks, Beth.
That was Cap Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Kaola. You're listening to Insight, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about a new series called Graying California and California's aging population. Cap Radio's food and sustainability reporter, Julia Mitrich, is also in the studio with me. And your reporting, Julia, took us in a different direction. You went to the Sierra foothills of Nevada County, and there are two main characters in your story.
That's right. Yeah, I drove up to Nevada City, a place that I had actually never been, believe it or not, to visit River Hill Farm, which is a really unusual farm. It's a beautiful place tucked right below a really steep ridge in the Sierra foothills where you wouldn't expect a farm to be. So you sort of come upon it. And that's where I met Alan Haight and his wife and farming partner, Joe McProud. And they both came to farming as a second career in their 40s. And they founded the farm in 2001. And back then, I mean, this is hard for us to believe now, but at that time and in that county, it wasn't a thing to say, oh, I have a local organic farm in my neighborhood. You know, that wasn't like a status symbol. Now, in a lot of parts of California, of course it is. But at that time, they grew this business selling organic veggies and fruit, mostly to folks in Nevada City. And now Joe and Alan are both 62, and they are part of a huge generational wave of farmers that is aging out of the fields. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the USDA just came out with its once every 5 years ag census, and they found that the average age of California farmers crept up to 59. Hmm. And that compares with a national average of 57. So this is a California thing. This is a U.S. thing in terms of the people who grow our food. And there are huge changes unfolding in this population. They face really big choices about how to handle their farm as they age out of the fields. And for this couple, I mean, sustainable farming is just their vocation, their passion, and you can hear it in their voices. So let's hear Alan, who's standing out in the fields of River Hill Farm. And he told me, even with his eyes closed, he knows the farm by heart.
I internalized this whole place. I know every change in the pitch of the ground. I know where the best soil is. I know where the outcroppings are. I know where the buried rocks are that are too big to move that I avoid hitting with the tractor.
And that's Alan. He's very poetical about his place.
I think there's the same sort of quality as the character in Sammy's story, Cliff, sort of mm-hmm. a reflective and mm-hmm. kind of encompassing look at life.
Yes, exactly. And maybe they're both artists in their own way. And Alan says from the very beginning when he started this farm, I mean, he was always thinking about what will happen to this farm beyond my ability to farm mm-hmm. it. First of all, because no one in his family no younger generation is planning on joining. This was his passion project, right? So this farm is just, you know, an idyllic place. But of course, like most farms, it takes a grueling level of physical labor to keep it running, never ending, planting, weeding, watering, running the farmer's market. And as Joe McProud points out, Alan's wife and farming partner, they were able to keep their stamina up through their 40s and 50s. But then, you know, as they approached their 60s, the sleep deprivation, the wear and tear caught up with them as they pushed towards 60. And now what do they do with this farm they created when no one else is planning to take it on? Here's Joe McProud.
One of the worst outcomes would have been that we just had to keep going beyond our ability to do it and worked ourselves into the ground, into an early grave. Or couldn't find someone and just had to close the farm. And that's happened in California, sadly. A farmer can't create a workable succession and they can't continue physically or financially or to keep farming. And so the farm goes out of business.
So what did they do?
Well, They faced some complex choices. You know, an expert I spoke with said of the 300 farming families he's worked with on farm succession over the last 40 years, no two are alike. There is no cookie cutter formula for solving this because every farm is different. Every family is different. The economy is different in each place. You could have multiple generations at this point involved in decision making about the farm. You could have somebody in their 80s, somebody in their 50s, and somebody in their 30s, all with different financial needs and divergent visions for what to do next, right? Like every generation. And then for Joe and Alan and sustainable farmers that I've interviewed all across California, there's another layer to this, which is sustainable farming is a long game. It's a practice that you do over years and years to improve the soil. And you want to find a successor who's willing and able, knowledgeable enough to take the reins, take those reins on and continue those farming practices. And so the next person needs to have that knowledge and the willingness. And Alan Haight calls it his legacy, you know, their legacy. And so they were lucky, they were fortunate to meet Antonio Garza. He was he had been farm manager at Soilborne Farms in Sacramento here, and he was 7 years into his farming career, really ready to run his own farm. And his dilemma was he couldn't afford to lease or buy land in California, which is a problem that many first-generation farms. So it was kind of a great marriage of the two. Joe and Alan still needed to draw income from their retirement. Antonio wanted to start farming on his own, and so now through California FarmLink, an organization that works precisely on these issues, they found a way that Antonio basically is now the day-to-day operator of the farm, and he inherits that business that Joe and Alan developed. And in return, Alan and Joe get to stay on the farm, and they draw an income by getting a monthly rent from Antonio. So it's really, you know, it's really ideal. And it sounds very niche, like this tiny farm in Nevada City, but from the farm succession experts that I spoke with, this is actually, these are the kinds of arrangements that people are coming up with, trying to figure out how to split the farm, the value of the farm, the economic value of the farm, in a way that the retiring farmer or couple can stay where they want to live, right? They want to be there. And so now they're all pretty happy about it. And you've got this younger couple, Antonio and his partner, who works part-time on the farm, and the retired couple all living on the farm. And Joe and Alan are pretty excited about planning road trips and seeing their grandchild who was just born. And they get to look out the window on a winter morning and see Antonio and Dalen, you know, harvesting the veggies. And they can sort of enjoy the farm without being tied to the day-to-day labor of it.
It is interesting how that light bulb goes on that says, start figuring out this last stretch of life between maybe second and third base and home plate. What's that picture going to look like? And then when there is a picture, I think the sense of relief. And Sammy, don't you think Cliff will feel that too, that that's really important to lock in the formula so that he can feel some peace in his life?
Yeah, absolutely. He's still trying to form his plan and who's going to be the people to take care of him. But I think when he figures that out, he'll feel a lot better.
Which is exactly what, as you're saying, Julia, they all look out the window and see in each other up on the farm.
That's right. And sometimes as people who might not be aging out of our professions at this very moment, we forget. I mean, people want to continue to have a meaningful, full life, regardless of what's happening to their body. We will all want to have meaning and community as we age. And so we're figuring it out for this generation of Californians, but we're really figuring it out for everyone.
That was said very succinctly, by the way. Cap Radio's food and sustainability reporter, Julia Mietrich. Thank you, Julia. And Cap Radio's healthcare reporter, Sammy Caola. Thank you, Sammy.
Thanks, Beth.
So their reporting is part of the California Dream Project series, Graying California. All the stories in this series, plus full-length interviews and photos, can be found at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. If you are piecing together your family tree through one of those commercial DNA testing companies, do listen to this conversation. There can be promises, pitfalls, and social risks in taking these tests. And two UC Davis professors will give a talk about all of those categories tonight at Davis Odd Fellows. The talk starts at 5:30. And they're joining me now from the UC Davis campus. Professor Gran Koop is professor of evolution and ecology. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
And assistant professor of religious studies is Megan O'Keefe. Professor O'Keefe, glad to have you with us as well.
Thank you so much.
So, good Professor Koop, what's your biggest concern about sending off that swab of saliva and then getting the DNA report back that gives you your ancestry and maybe a few clues about your health?
So there's, you know, these companies are incredibly popular, and around 26 million people have done them so far. And, you know, a lot of people are finding out interesting things about their family history. They're finding out about relatives they've never known they had. They're finding out something interesting about their ancestry. And that's all well and good. But the issue is that people can mistake their sort of genetic ancestry for what they're learning about their cultural ancestry. And so there's a risk that people sort of confuse what they know about their family history with sort of deeper ideas about who they are. And so that's a real concern.
Is this craze a global craze, or are Americans much more into this, Professor Koop, than the rest of the world is?
So I think it's fair to say that it's a fairly US phenomena. It's certainly caught on in Europe and a number of other places, but the vast majority of the customers are American.
In your writing about genetic ancestry and personal genomics, you analyze statistics, but do you do this more than looking at the individual stories? And is that a pitfall of this process, is that when you send off your DNA, you're really just being compared to whatever data bank exists?
Yes. So the databases that these companies have are large, but they are biased in certain directions towards people of European ancestry. And so people of European ancestry can get potentially quite high resolution looks at where they come from. But people from elsewhere in the world can often get a far blurrier picture and sometimes incorrect picture.
And are you in favor of everybody sharing their DNA results with family members and friends, kind of putting it all up there for discussion at the holiday table?
I think that's a really personal decision, right? So, for example, my own father says that he doesn't want to do these tests because he doesn't want to know how he's going to die. And clearly the test isn't going to tell him how he's going to die. But I think that's a common reaction, that some family members just don't want to know this information. And we should respect that and have that discussion with them before doing these tests.
Professor O'Keefe, this is some of the arena, isn't it, where you come at this category of DNA testing. What's your area of study and concern about it?
Well, I have a number of concerns. I share some of Graham's concerns here. And I think the two areas that are particularly troubling are these questions of identity, that somehow we think that if we know our genetic code, it says something essential and unchangeable about us, that there's a kind of determinism to it. And I think in some ways this sort of discourages people from changing the things they can change in terms of health and that sort of thing. And at sort of the uglier end of it, it can mean that people have deterministic ideas about particular groups of people, and that this can reinforce stereotypes and prejudices and that sort of thing. So I think that's a real concern. And then the other half, I would say, is about privacy. And I want to pick up on what Graham just said about this idea that when somebody in your family tests their genes, finds out their genetic profile, they're also telling you your genetic profile to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And so in a case like with a disease like Huntington's, if a person has the Huntington's gene, they will have Huntington's disease. And there's a 50-50 chance that they'll pass it on to their children. So if you're a kid, if you know there's a history of Huntington's, if one of your parents has Huntington's, and your child, your adult child, decides to get this test and they have it, that tells you that you have it. And, you know, the interesting thing about the Huntington's test is that the majority of people who are at risk choose not to have the test because it's a terrible disease, and if you have it, there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. We don't have any treatment for it.
So back to a point that I made in the introduction, and that is that you might just get this report by email or in the mail, and you're looking down the list, and in your example, Professor O'Keefe, there it says, you know, the gene showed up, and you knew nothing about it before. I think in the clinical or the healthcare setting, healthcare workers are very careful about this kind of information being presented to you. It's totally different when you're just commercial testing your DNA and you get those results, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a real problem. And they don't really, I mean, there's a huge shortage of genetic counselors generally across the United States. And these companies are giving out information that people do need help understanding and processing and that sort of thing, and the support just isn't there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a geneticist, and I look at this information, and I'm not sure what to do with it. And if I, as a geneticist, aren't sure what to do with it, you can imagine that the average person's just going to be at sea with this stuff.
And where are we going with it? Is there a point at which you're going to be irresponsible if you don't test your DNA and you aren't part of the sharing and the illumination of who we really are?
Yeah, I mean, I think these companies, their market share is increasing dramatically. And so a lot of people are getting this information. A lot of people are sharing this information with their family. And I think we do need to start having a public discussion about how we think about this information, how we use this information. Are we comfortable with insurers knowing this information? How should we protect our genetic information? And, you know, also how does that interface with things like law enforcement, which is another area where it gets complicated?
Yeah, I just want to echo that. And I think this sort of idea of responsibility is something that comes up a lot with prenatal testing. And, you know, the sort of companies that are trying to market themselves to parents, there's this sort of implication that in order to prepare for the birth of your child, in order to be responsible, you need to have this whole set of tests. And again, for a lot of these the things that they test for, there either aren't treatments or there's very little that you can do. And the idea is, like, maybe you can prepare, but it is presented as, like, it's your responsibility to do this. And I'm not convinced that it is. And I think in terms of privacy, this is a real concern that law enforcement agencies may have access to some of these DNA profiles. And it depends on which company you use and whether you agree to participate in research, whether or not your DNA will be searchable. For instance, if you, on 23andMe, if you check that you want to participate in research, then you're protected under HIPAA, so the Patient Privacy Act. But, you know, on the other hand, you're also handing over your sort of DNA and your genetic profile to a company for them to do with it what they please. And I think that may be a concern for some of us.
Yeah.
That is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies Megan O'Keefe and Professor of Evolution and Ecology at UC Davis Graham Koop. And their talk this evening, 5:30 to 6:30 at Davis Odd Fellows, is titled The Promises, Pitfalls, and Social Risks of DNA Testing. Davis Odd Fellows is at 415 Second Street. Let's stay with that law enforcement point for a moment, because most of the country and much of the world knows that the Sacramento County DA, Anne-Marie Schubert, has become a DNA expert and continues with other law enforcement entities to use DNA databases to solve crimes, the most high profile, of course, being an arrest made in the decades-old East Area rapist case, the Golden State Killer case. Should there be limits? What does each of you think about limits to law enforcement use of this DNA search information?
So, yeah, I think that's complicated. So the first thing to say, as Megan pointed out, is if your data is in 23andMe and Ancestry, the police would have a lot of difficulty getting access to that information. But there are other services such as GEDmatch, where people have voluntarily uploaded their DNA to look for family tree matches to learn more about themselves. And those services, the access to those are far easier. And that is indeed what the law enforcement did to trace the Golden State Killer. The access to that is fairly open, and at the moment, I think there's relatively few limits on how such searches can be performed.
Yeah, as a result of the Maryland v. King case in 2013, it's a Supreme Court case that allowed warrantless searches of genetic material. And this is a question, this wasn't somebody who was using one of these ancestry databases, but rather a man who had been arrested. They had taken his DNA, and he ended up being put on trial for rape, but the DNA had been collected in a different case. And, you know, the difficulty is that when you look at whose DNA is in police databases, it's going to be overwhelmingly people of color. And so what you have is sort of a database that is already biased in one direction. And you know, which is a concern. The other concern is that nationally there is no standard for how criminal, forensic labs process DNA. They're not regulated. There's voluntary compliance, and there's been a number of cases where DNA evidence has been mishandled. For instance, the Austin Police Department basically had to shut down their lab because there were a number of different cases about mishandling the samples. They were mislabeled. They were using the wrong reagent, and there was some real doubt. And the problem is when you get to trial and people talk about DNA evidence, it's, you know, sort of treated as the gold standard. Mm-hmm. But when you have this kind of mishandling, it can be a real problem. And the same thing happened in New York with 800 rape cases where they actually had cross-contamination of samples. So you know, it's a question of who is in these criminal databases, but also how much can we trust these forensic labs to get it right?
The things to know then, what the absolutes here are, number one, DNA doesn't lie, but you just use the word contamination. To be sure that it is your DNA, your clear DNA is really important, and I don't know how any of us can get that guarantee. But number two, I want to go back to something that you said, Professor Koop, in the beginning, and that is that the DNA doesn't reflect where you grew up, what your influences might be, what your personality might be, and a whole lot of other parts of a self.
Yeah, I think that's true, right? Like, these DNA testing companies tell us interesting things about our family histories, but it's not the be-all and end-all of who we are. And as these companies get more popular, as they sort of penetrate our psyche more, it's easy to make that mistake of thinking that they're telling us something fundamental about ourselves when they're just telling us one aspect of our family history. And so that's a really important thing to keep in mind. They're fun, but it's, you know, just a part of the complicated picture of who we are.
It's also still a statistical game. I was just in a family conversation with part of the family saying, we always thought we were such and such, but when we got tested, none of that showed up, but it's also a very small subset of all nationalities in the world. So isn't it possible that statistically there just wasn't enough there to show up?
Yeah, I think these tests are getting better over time, but I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about exactly how accurate they are, and that accuracy differs across different groups of people, right? So it's useful, but I think it's also worth taking it with a pinch of salt and should be, you know, sort of combined with other means of studying family history.
Yeah, I think one interesting example about this is people of African descent in the United States who want to trace their ancestry because this is something that has been denied them, sort of an entire history kind of ripped away from people. But and there are some testing site organizations that concentrate on African ancestry, but we still have the problem that there aren't enough samples from Africa, and it's a big place, and it is incredibly genetically diverse. So you're not going to get the same kind of rich picture. And ironically, for those people who do really, who don't have access to the same kinds of genealogy records that, say, white European, people of white European ancestry do in the United States.
Yeah, totally agree.
Well, I feel like we just gave a really fascinating introduction to your speech tonight. And I'll remind everybody that you will be at Davis Odd Fellows this evening, April 24th, from 5:30 to 6:30. And we'll post a link on the website. I believe space is limited, so people should check that out first. And Professor Graham Koop and Professor Megan O'Keefe from UC Davis, thanks so much. This is a topic that I know we're only at the beginnings of being able to really explore and understand.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight Live on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Sometimes we have very young listeners, so at this moment, I want to give a warning about the conversation I'm going to have with writer Rachel Howard. Her debut novel, titled The Risk of Us, is about a young couple and their adoption process. But while we're talking about this new novel, we are going to talk a bit about her memoir from 2005, titled The Lost Night. And it details Rachel's real-life experience when she was 10. Her dad was killed. It was an unsolved murder, and she was trying to piece together what happened. So again, I ask you to please use discretion in who might be listening right now to this conversation. And I'm happy to have Rachel Howard with me in the studio. It's lovely to meet you, and I really am enjoying your work. Thanks for being here.
I'm so grateful to you for having me.
So at age 10, the murder happened. How old were you then when you could actually see this as a thing, a childhood trauma that had happened in your life and would forever frame and in some ways define who you were?
Yeah, and it happened in our own house when I was there, and I came out and saw blood up and down the hallway and saw my dad carried out. Immediately after, I wasn't able to be with it because I had to go live with an abusive stepfather back at home, and I was given some Valium, and I wasn't really ready to talk, so not much processing beyond that. Then when a romantic relationships come into a person's life, that starts to bring all of this up with losing a father in a shocking way. Mm-hmm. So I think at about 18, I actually started secretly trying to write about it. And then I at college, started having a breakdown, and I knew that was at the root.
When you finally wrote about it, and that was the process of trying to confront it and piece together what had happened, what did you get back in terms of sharing your story across the country? What came back to you?
I don't really know, actually. I mean, I do hear from a lot of people who have lost their own parents, who have been moved by the book, and it's given them the strength to face it. I do still, even now, more than a decade later, get emails from people having that response. And also just, I think, feeling that they don't have to go around thinking that they're freaks. Someone else has gone through this, and is moving on, not necessarily moving on. I mean, I don't want to say that it's you move on. It's always part of your life, but instead of being a negative story about yourself, it can become a positive one if you move through it and it becomes something that you faced.
You talked with Ira Glass for a segment in an episode of This American Life, and I really learned something from that about the sensitivity and the awareness in how someone sees and hears the world based on a traumatic experience. And I'd like to share a clip from that show. It was in 2007. The theme was Rest in Peace. And the two of you were talking about how the subject of murder or death is handled in popular culture. Are you okay if I share a clip from that segment?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's listen. Here's Ira Glass.
You know how murder figures into so much of American pop culture on crime shows and thrillers and video games and all kinds of stuff? Well, if you knew somebody who actually got murdered, turns out you might not be into that stuff so much.
I can't watch Law & Order. Not going to watch Law & Order. Or play Clue. Or, you know, go to a murder mystery dinner theater.
Rachel Howard's dad was killed when she was 10. And as an adult, she's met a lot of people whose family members were killed. Now, she says that some of them love shows like CSI and Murder, She Wrote, any kind of murder show. Officially, organizations like the group Parents of Murdered Children take a stand against murderous entertainment.
So they do. Go ahead.
Oh, no, it's just, it's interesting that you bring that up again, because actually in my Facebook feed a couple of days ago, the new trend, there's this advertisement for Have a Date Night In, and it's a Solve a Murder kit. So it's still coming up in the culture a lot.
Do you still react to it the same way? So this is now 12 years later. Where are you now with all of this? And I do want to say that even as you were recounting what happened when you were 10, I could see the emotion in your face and in your eyes. It comes up pretty evidently.
Yeah, definitely. I'd still choose. I mean, I'm not going to play Murder Mystery Night game with my husband. At the same time, I don't feel angry towards people who are engaging in that kind of entertainment. I understand that they didn't have the experiences that I did, and so I'm not going to blame them for ignorance, but, you know, if it happened to them, they probably wouldn't be playing that. So I don't think I go into, like, a place of shock or, like, panicked avoidance, but it's still not something I'm going to choose to do. And yeah, for the way that the emotion comes back, I mean, there are definitely moments when I can still come back into that reality of that night, and also not knowing what happened. We don't know who killed him, and am I ever going to know? And I can sink into that and be in that emotional place. But what happens after you write a book about trauma? I'm also realizing that I did a lot of different things. So, like, once I finished the book, I really felt that I was profoundly in a different story of my life. And that part of my life was contained within the book covers, and I could go back there, but I didn't have to every day relive it. But I did some other things, like I became very influenced by a certain strain of Christianity that's big on paradox and religion. That kind of religion became important to me. I was very formed at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. And I also started doing a lot of reading in Buddhism and meditation groups. So there were all these kinds of practices that kind of teach you to stay with painful things in a calm way. And so when the feeling comes up, I don't necessarily feel threatened by it, though. I can just be with the feeling.
I'm going to use that as a segue to this novel you wrote, The Risk of Us. There's a 7-year-old girl in the story who is in the foster system. We don't know all the details of the trauma that she experienced. It informs the story, though. And to me, you treat her trauma almost as a character.
Mm.
It kind of becomes this entity that plays throughout, and when it acts up, everything's all in capital letters. And it is the person that's there. And even though you have said the memoir didn't influence heavily the story, you are there in the character of the mom, and the trauma is there in the character of the little girl.
Yeah, definitely. So the impetus for the two books was very different, because with the memoir, it was about me. I needed to write that story to unearth things, understand my life, and investigate myself. And with this book, there was a point of entry of being in the foster care system and seeing how emotionally complex it was, and how one moment could be really difficult and painful, and the next moment could be really surprising and beautiful. And moving between this panic of how can we help this little girl, and then having a breakthrough, and those things stand side by side. And so the impetus there was not to understand myself. The story was, like, in a weird way, profoundly not about me, but just to investigate that kind of crucible of these three people trying to help each other.
Let me point out that the couple in the story is trying to, or hoping to, exploring whether to adopt Marisa, mm-hmm. a little 7-year-old. You are an adoptive parent yourself. Did the title of this book come from a brochure that you actually saw?
Yeah, it did. So one of the first lines is, the brochure at the Foster Services Agency asks for families that take risks. And that is a brochure that I saw, and that was part of the catalyst for the book, because I thought, you know, usually you're advertised for parents who are stable and secure and loving, but why would you want parents who take risks? That seemed to be saying something in a coded way about what the situation is really like. And then coming back to the trauma, though, I'm glad you brought that up, because the point of my life that I decided to keep in the novel, even though it's a novel, is this woman, the narrator, who's speaking the story to the 7-year-old girl and her husband, having a childhood murder in her own background. Mm-hmm. Because to me, as a fictional element, she's coming in feeling like she has this point of empathy. And I love that you're saying that the trauma is almost its own character in the book, because she does. She feels like, well, I'm going to understand what's going on. I can remember having those kinds of panic attacks myself, and that's going to help me break through and do this kind of parenting. And then that really gets put to the test. Does that empathy, is that enough? If you can understand what the person is going through still, how do you break through? And then the mother who's trying to adopt also has these moments of being brought to a deep humility, because she realizes even what she went through may not be as bad as what this little girl has gone through.
You're listening to Nevada City author Rachel Howard. Her debut novel is The Risk of Us. I am going to ask you to read from the book, but let's go to election night.
Okay.
Let's go to the segment of the book when there had been a family gathering. There was going to be a meeting with a therapist. I don't know if you want to set it up anymore.
I think that's great. We drive to Grandma Annie and Papa's for Thanksgiving. Your uncle and aunt and your cousins meet us there. You scream a lot at bedtime, refuse to take baths or brush teeth. Your uncle and aunt and their kids stay outside in a motorhome while we stay in the house's guest room, and your uncle and I have some good midnight chats. Not the smoothest of holidays, no, but to be honest, I hardly remember it. What I do remember from that November is our first session with the new therapist, the one out in the country with the 4-legged assistants. How you fed the dappled gelding and the bay mare, petted the cat, played tug-of-war with the chihuahua, how the new therapist said anything you shared there could be your secret, and how, when you didn't believe her, she pointed to the horizon and said, "No one can hear us out here, so go ahead, Marisa, scream." And your scream echoed over the rolling hills. But there was something new in it, something like freedom. When the session was finished, the therapist held the dog's paw and waved by and said, "We're all very pleased to meet you, Marisa, and I'd say we're off to a great start." Daddy drove and I sat in the front seat on the way home, you in the back. The long stretch from the dirt road to the twisty paved one. We strained to hear the voices on the radio filling airtime, waiting for the election returns. The oak leaves yellow, the maple leaves red, the sunset burning a shade I'd call hope. "Our first woman president," Daddy said. "Shh," I said, "don't jinx it." But I was smiling. You from the back seat. "So they're not going to build a wall?"
Set on election night.
Mm-hmm.
I have said that the book is startling because you take us through some very rough terrain. You also take us into love, and it raised the question for me, could love be enough? Do you think love can be enough?
And that's a big topic in the foster care world. And part of the reason I wanted to explore this here in a way that I think fiction can do, that nonfiction can't always, because in fiction, it's about these characters. And so judgment can be suspended. And you can try to have empathy for everyone. And it doesn't have to appeal to what is in the quote-unquote real world. You're just in this protected space of exploring without judgment. But yeah, people in the foster care system, you know, they speak passionately in both ways. Love is ultimately what heals a person. And you don't know. Sometimes you can love with all your heart and not get the outcome you hope for.
The new Surgeon General, the first Surgeon General of California, wants to focus on childhood trauma as an important area for research, for screening, for assistance. How do those words sound to you?
I think that would be fabulous. I think what is needed, I recommend at the end of the book, I put some footnotes on the actual parenting books that I quote, even though it's fiction within the book. And one of them is Besser van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score. And I can't recommend it highly enough. And one thing that's interesting that he points to, so first off, the two most dependably traumatized populations are veterans and children in foster care. Mm. And the thing that he really finds through MRI studies and empirical research that helps people is singing, art, theater, playing. You know, sometimes the work that happens, it doesn't happen like in the book, the cinder block building, the institutional building that they have to go to see the first therapist. Tremendous healing happens through art. So I hope that they'll keep investigating those ways of healing too.
Where can people see you real quickly? Do you have anything coming up in the area?
Yeah, so I'll be at Time Tested Books in Sacramento tomorrow night, Thursday at 7.
Okay. We'll post more online, including the This American Life episode and links to your website. Rachel, it's a delight to meet you. I look forward to working together with you again.
Thank you so much.
That is Rachel Howard. Her debut novel is The Risk of Us. Her memoir from 2005 is titled The Lost Night. There's more at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our senior producer is Helen Barrington. Our producers are Cody Drabble, Bert Johnson, and Kate Gonzalez. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer, Antonio Munoz. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.